It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
And welcome to another episode of Relentlessly Resilient, where real live people share their real life experiences and the tools they've learned to still live their best lives. I'm Jenny Taylor.
And I'm Michelle Scharf. I am so excited today. I have with us John and Monica English on the show. John and Monica and I, we go back years, like decades.
About 23 years.
Yeah, 22 years. It's a long time. I think some of our political friends, John, might be surprised to know that we've known each other for that long and that we shared some really kind of sacred space of life together. And just how much I have so much love and admiration for you. I'm very excited to talk today with you both for a couple reasons. One, you're really a part of what this podcast is. I've mentioned it on other podcasts. After Talia died, you guys really honored her with a beautiful funeral service. And we're going to be talking about Talia, their daughter, today. And we'll get into that story in a little bit. But when she passed away, you guys had this very unique funeral service that really expanded my mind as to what a farewell could be for someone you loved. And you guys don't know this, but I actually started planning my children and my husband's funerals just because I was a planner and I'm very controlling and I'm psychotic at times. But it was my way of feeling like I had some control. I think that Talia's death impacted me in a way that I was very fearful about losing my own children and also losing anyone that I loved. And if that was going to happen, I wanted to be able to honor them in a way that was very fitting and beautiful for them. And so I did. Every few years, I would kind of rehearse in my mind, like, what would be that beautiful, appropriate thing to be, so that I felt like if something should happen, I wouldn't be caught completely off guard. I did that for years, and it did help me when the time came to lose John. So your guys' stories is a part of me learning to understand that life is fragile. It's a part of me learning to understand that we could lose our children. We can lose people that we love, and that they don't have to be our family members to have a deep connection, and they don't even have to be older in our lives very long. So yes. I wanted to just start out by sharing with our listeners and with you guys, we've never really talked about this because you guys had your own grief, and I never felt like it was important to have this conversation, but here we are. So I'm going to share. I remember you came over to a Blessing Way, which was like a baby shower for those of you that don't know what a Blessing Way is. It's kind of like a birthy woman's version of a baby shower. And you had Talia with you, and she was probably, I don't know, 6 to 8 months old, maybe at the time. I think it was for Haley's, Blessing Way. And I remember holding her, and I was full with this big belly. And I remember holding her, and I looked down at her and those big, luscious blue eyes staring back at me. And I felt this soul connection. I felt this energetic, deep knowing of who this person was. And I had never really even experienced that with my own children in that deep of a connection. And in that moment, she stole a part of my heart, and she was forever a part of my heart.
And she had a way of doing that. She really did.
And she was maybe a baby and maybe young when she passed, but she was larger than life. She was so big. Her spirit was enormous. she made a huge impact. So I just wanted to share with you guys that connection that I had with Talia. I know that you guys know that I love her. I did what I could as far as like putting scrapbooks together for you guys when you weren't able to do that.
Still have it. It's amazing.
And
to have all of those together.
Yeah. It's funny. My kids don't have their own scrapbooks. They often like, why don't we have scrapbooks? I'm like, oh, I was too busy doing them for other people. Anyway. I just love her so much. I'm excited to have this format, to be able to have you guys share with us the impact that Talia made, not only on my heart, but to Utah as well. So share it with us. Tell us about Talia and your story.
Okay. Well, when we got pregnant with Talia, we already had our two other children, and we thought everything was fine. And then when she was 9 weeks old, we thought she really should have been able to pick her head up by now.
And when she was on her belly, she couldn't lift her head off the ground.
She was on her belly and couldn't lift her head off the ground. And the midwife had commented that she was really floppy when she was born. And we took her to the doctor, and I'll never forget the ice that ran through my veins when he was doing a reflex test and her legs didn't move.
Oh.
And we were really worried. Something was really wrong here. And for a while, they thought it might be cerebral palsy. I remember just the...
Yeah, just that first day, everybody was kind of guessing. And the doctor said, we're just going to send you to primaries because there's something not right here.
Yeah, so the tests finally, they finally were able to settle on the diagnosis of type 1 spinal muscular atrophy, which I'd never heard of. And I remember Monica was doing research, and I believe I was at work when she called me to let me know what the diagnosis was and was just crying. Because we had looked at like four different things, and SMA was the worst sounding one. And that's what it was. And it's a condition where the nerves in her muscles didn't work. And so she just could not get stronger.
Yeah, it's the nerves and the motor neurons. So anything you can control voluntarily was incredibly weak for her. So people think of arms and legs and walking, but it also was intercostal muscles for breathing, muscles for swallowing. We knew from early on that it would be progressive, that she would lose strength for a period of time and then even out. But within those first 8-9 months, she lost the ability to swallow. So she got a G tube, or she actually got an NG tube, the one that goes in the nose. And she was incredibly weak. We learned of a doctor in New Jersey, who was treating kids with SMA differently, and they had a longer lifespan. Here in Utah, this is in 2000, so this is a while ago, but here in Utah, we were told to take her home and love her because there was nothing we could do. She was going to die. And she would probably die within the first year, was what we were told. So I connected in with other families and moms online, who ended up being the best resource of anyone you could talk to. And they pointed me to this doctor in Newark, New Jersey. And I flew out. John had just got a new job, so he couldn't come with me. So me and my mom flew out to this terrible area in inner city Newark, New Jersey, to see this doctor who was using different approaches, using a BiPAP machine at really high spans rather than to help expand her lungs. And another machine called a cough assist machine that would give a really big breath in, like you take in when you're going to cough, and then has a negative pressure to pull it out. So it simulated a cough and could move things that she couldn't move on her own that were clogging up her lungs. So I spent 10 days in Newark because it turned out she needed a more complex surgery, but came home with a baby on the airplane with a brand new G tube and surgical scars. But when we came back, I went in to see the doctor here. There was a newer doctor at Primary Children's who specialized in SMA, and she was very interested in knowing what we were doing, because even within just a couple of months, Talia's chest wall looked so much better than kids without the machines that we had to help her expand her lungs. We had morning and night therapies every single day of her life that took a good 45 minutes of kind of like you do with cystic fibrosis, where you pat the chest wall to loosen things up, and then you go through a process to cough, use the cough assist, and then a suction machine to suction out anything that has come up.
And when I remember sick, you doing that. I remember you bringing her to my house and staying the night. Yeah. And I got to see all of that firsthand. It was a lot. It was a lot of work.
Yeah. And we, those machines, we took them with her anywhere, because if her airway clogged, we could use the cough assist machine. It would pull things through and she would be just fine. But the couple of times that I went out without that machine thinking she was okay, we had some scary, scary moments, because she would choke and she couldn't cough saliva out of her airway. She couldn't swallow her own saliva. And so we were constantly suctioning her. All of that said, SMA does not affect the brain and it doesn't affect your social ability. And she had the brightest eyes and loved to connect in with people. Even though she couldn't lift her elbows off the ground to give you a hug, she would look at people. She spoke in kind of a garbled voice because she couldn't enunciate very well, but I could translate for her. And she loved to show off her equipment. I remember taking her into a group of kids she was going to be around, and we went in with her machines and said, hey, we want to introduce you to Talia, and here are the machines that she used. And she was so excited to be up in the middle of this group of kids who were interested. You know, little kids, they take everything at face value. And so you say, this is the way we suction her mouth, and they go, oh, cool. Rather than adults who might get a little, wigged out.
Yeah. Not know what to do.
But we had, she couldn't be propped up for very long. So we had a wheelchair that was completely flat. It had her BiPAP machine under there with a battery that would run it, and the cough assist and the suction unit and the feeding pump and an oxygen tank often. And we just figured out how to make life work around all sorts of new medical needs after she was born. But we knew that that's what, that the equipment, the procedures we went through didn't just extend her life, but it really gave her much better quality of life in the ability to clear her airway out. We had lots of hospital trips, some very emergent. One of the scariest ones, before we knew she had to be flat all the time, we had her up. I had her up in a seat, watching a show, and another person was there and had gone to do dishes. And I stepped into the bedroom, and in just a few minutes, she choked. Mm-hmm. And my sister, who was the one with me, cried out for me, and I came running into the living room, and Talia was the color of a Barney doll. She was absolutely purple. And I put her down and we started doing mouth to mouth and called 911. They tried to intubate her on the living room floor. They ended up not being able to because they didn't have pediatric sized intubation tubes. And so they put her in the ambulance and went with full sirens going through red lights to the hospital. And the ride to the hospital kind of shook things loose. And by the time we got to the hospital, she was awake again and kind of looking around and like, what's a big deal? and we learned from that time on that when she had those choking moments, the cough assist did a better job than anything an ambulance could bring. But the cough assist, we had the only one in Utah at the time. When we'd come into the emergency room, they would recognize the machine and say, "Oh, I remember you. You have that machine." The first time Talia was hospitalized after we had the cough assist machine, I was really scared because Primary Children's didn't have one. They didn't know this machine. It sounded
right
scary to the respiratory therapists who were saying, "No, you can't use those types of pressures." And we would have to explain that the pressures are not for breathing. Breathing at the high levels of pressures that we used would damage lungs. But for a few breaths as a cough, it was really helpful. And that first hospital stay after the machine, I remember we had like a half a dozen respiratory therapists and nurses and doctors standing at the end of the bed as I went to use the cough assist machine with, you know, one eyebrow up going, "We don't know." And there were the pulmonologists at Primary Children's at the time were not very, they didn't like the cough assist machine and they let me
right.
know it.
Yeah. And well, cause it was new
really
and it was
bold
yeah.
about saying, "No, we will keep doing this."
Right. Cause it was new and it was just something that they didn't even know how to instruct you on. So like they didn't want you to have it there. We need to take a break. When we come back, sure. we are going to talk more about Talia and, the innovations and changes that have taken place in care with children with SMA and, the subsequent story of what you guys have gone through and your loss of your daughter. We'll be right back.
Two years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
"You want me to come when you deliver your baby?"
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com, follow us on Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
And we're back with John and Monica English. We're talking today about their daughter, Talia, who was diagnosed at a very young age with SMA and that spinal muscular atrophy. Is that right,
yes.
Monica?
Yes.
And subsequently, because, I really think it's because this daughter was born to Monica and she is a tireless warrior and an advocate and, comes natural to her and she, is smart and educated and will ferociously fight for her children. She was able to find resources and dig and research and find access to other moms that with children with diagnosed with SMA and be able to find some innovative therapies and bring them into Utah, but also to help with the research study and innovations that have taken place in the past 20 years with SMA. So Monica and John, finish telling us, tell us more about Talia and the road that you guys walked together.
Well, I would say that as she got older and she passed the time that doctors said she would live to, we were told 90% are dead before they turn two. And, you know, we got her second birthday, we got her third birthday. We were feeling really good and positive about what we were able to do. But it was also this fairly new disease that they didn't really know much about. And we were just doing whatever we could to find any resource we could for a cure, for different treatments. And one thing that happened was our next child was born. CJ was born when she was 2 and a half, I think. Mm-hmm. And we got an in utero to diagnose, and we were told that CJ would have SMA as well. And I just remember pulling over, hearing the news, and just really wishing our next child could be healthy. But we had to prepare ourselves for that. And
it's a big thing to prepare for. Like, you guys have just gone through all of this description of her therapies morning and night. Now you're thinking about adding an additional child to this, and you have healthy children in your home that need all the regular care that healthy children need, but you're also having to do all of these extra cares. And this is a child that really can't be left unattended for really moments at all, because the price is their life. They could stop breathing at any time.
Yep. And that went just, it went to say just as well at the, when we were in the hospital, the way and the approach to respiratory care with Talia was so unique and different that the doctors did not know how to help her. So I was there. I was there. John was there 90% of the time. And the 10% of the time that we would take away, usually something would go wrong. Someone wouldn't know how to use one of the machines, or they'd try to push her too hard and fast. So I mean, my poor kids, I would call 911 with an incident that didn't give me 10 minutes warning. I would call for an ambulance. I would get into that ambulance and leave my 3-4-year-old daughter and my 7-year-old son, and they didn't know if they would see me the next day or not for 3 weeks.
Right.
I remember those days. Because I was managing, managing Talia's care. And I remember sitting down with the chaplain at Primary Children's and saying, I feel like I'm sacrificing my other children for Talia. I just didn't know how to be both places at the same time, and had to trust that my kids would be resilient enough to and grow to understand, even if they didn't when they were younger. It's hard to be the sibling of a medically fragile child. And we've learned more as our kids have grown up, as they share things that they experienced that we weren't aware at the time. It's hard to be a sibling with a parent that might leave at any moment and be gone for weeks.
Yeah.
At the time, we just couldn't trust the hospitals to really know how to handle her.
it got so that, when Dr. Swoboda, who was the specialist that most cared for Talia, when she would go out of town, if there was a child with SMA in the hospital, she would call us and ask us if we could help walk the parents through the care their children were receiving, because we knew better at that point. We'd read and learned, and we knew how to manage this really unique.
Well, and you guys were really helping rewrite cares.
Yeah.
Standards of care. It's amazing. So
when Talia was 4, almost just a few days before she turned 4, I went to teach.
Can we slow down a bit?
Yeah, go ahead.
I wanted to get more into CJ before we got to that. But CJ was diagnosed with SMA, and SMA has different types. There's type 1, 2, 3, and 4. Mm-hmm. And we were told that, you know, it's a genetic condition. And so if they're born with a certain type, then everyone in the family that gets it will have the same type. So we started doing therapies immediately on newborn CJ. But CJ started showing the strength of a regular baby. And we thought it must be our awesome parenting and therapies that we do. And we got a head start on this that we didn't have with Talia. And you know, CJ was able to pick up his head. He was able to, elbows off the ground, all that stuff.
The moment I knew something was really different, I had always been able to put, Talia couldn't roll over. There was no way. And so I would lay her on a counter by the window so she could see out, she could see into the kitchen. Well, I did the same thing with CJ when CJ was a baby, and CJ rolled off the counter, and I felt like a horrible mom, but I was so both excited. Going, oh my gosh, is he hurt? But wow, look what he did.
Yeah, when CJ, after they were born, we put a feeding tube up their nose, just like what Talia had in the beginning. But the doctors, you know, as they were looking at tests, CJ wasn't showing symptoms. And at 4 months old, we ripped that tube out of his nose and was like, well, he doesn't need it. And so now they're all confused. He has SMA, but he has no symptoms. So we were getting some bright side encouragement from that.
Right.
And I just kind of throw out there that, well, that was nice. And I needed CJ to come up before we got to where we're going. So 2 days before Talia was going to turn 4, Monica went off to teach one of her classes. And I had been laid off recently, so I was home with the kids a lot. But that particular day, I had gone off to play soccer with some friends. And I came home, and the three kids were in the living room watching Little Mermaid. And, well, I'm not sure where Natalie was, but Ethan was asleep on the couch. And I looked at Talia, and she was gray.
Yeah, we had a really quick handoff. I had to run out the door to the class. Talia was fine. Yeah. John was making spaghetti on the dinner, and the movie ended. Mm.
That's right, the spaghetti. So I just looked over at Talia, and she was gray. And then I noticed all of her equipment was off, and they were all unplugged. And the thing about her equipment is when they get unplugged, they immediately set off alarms. And so I have no idea why they weren't setting off alarms. I have no idea how they got unplugged. But she was gray, and I looked at her, and I shook her, and I said, Talia, and deep down, I knew she was already dead, but I still went through the motions of, like, waking Ethan up, calling 911, doing all the CPR, mouth-to-mouth and everything, and had to keep 911 on the phone, 911, as I was doing all this. I knew I wanted to call Monica, but I had no way to, since I had to have 911 on the call. I kicked Ethan awake and made him get the spaghetti off the stove. And I found out later that he had felt guilty about not doing more at the time. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, there is absolutely nothing you could have done.
No.
So once the ambulance pulled up to our house, I was able to hang up on them, call Monica. Monica was trying to get a hold of me because, I forgot something.
I was on my way back home already.
I called her, and before she could even speak, I just said, come home now. As urgently as possible. And she was like, okay, because she could just tell whatever it was, just be quiet and come home now. And, you know, yeah, the paramedics were started to do their work on her. I mean, deep down, I knew she was already gone. But, and then Monica came in. I remember her seeing that. And just,
yeah. I drove up to my house, and there was a fire truck and an ambulance and neighbor standing in the yard. And I ran in the house, and I looked at her, and I knew it. I knew she was gone. And one of the things that I had put off doing was getting an advance directive for her. And so I came in and saw paramedics doing CPR on my child, and I knew there was no hope. And I said, it's my fault. And I hit the wall, and there was a policeman there, and he stopped and said, what's your fault? And I said, no, I didn't get an advance directive. And he said to John, control your wife.
Well, yeah, he tried to like distract you with like, hey, who are these pictures on the wall? It's like, and then he just looked at me and said, control your wife. And I just grabbed Monica by both arms. What did I even say? I just took you by both arms. I said something.
Yeah. And I stopped and I looked at the policeman. I said, I'm not going to get in the way, but I need to touch my daughter. Yeah. And I walked over and I said, to the paramedics, how do we stop this? And they looked at me, and I found out later from a paramedic friend, they said, parents of young children never ask for CPR to be stopped. But for me, I knew this was. And they said, well, we need to go to the hospital. I said, okay. So they put her into the ambulance, and we got into our car and drove right behind it to the hospital, where we went in and I said, okay, stop. And I was asked, stop what? And I said, stop compression, stop mouth to mouth, stop everything. She's gone. And they did. And, you know, they cleared out pretty quick, and we had, we held her. She was still warm, of course, she had just passed, and I knew that was going to change. I called, we called family to come, my brother, my mother, brothers and sisters-in-law came to say goodbye to her. And as the night was getting later, I wanted to call the specialist, the neuromuscular specialist who was studying SMA. And I was able to track down the nurse. And I said, just, you can have anything you want from her body. She doesn't need it anymore. Is there anything that would be useful? And they, I got a call back from the doctor herself, and Dr. Swoboda told us that they could really use a particular nerve from the arm and the spinal column. And I said, great. And hung up the phone in, of course, in tears. And she called back and said, are you still at the hospital? If I get in my car in Salt Lake and drive to Provo or drive to Orem, will you be there? And we said, yeah. And so this wonderful doctor drove all the way down to the hospital where Talia was to be able to hold my daughter and say goodbye, because she'd been such an involved part of research with her. When the time came that we needed to separate from our daughter, the thought of leaving her alone in a hospital room and walking away was devastating to me. And Dr. Swoboda said, well, I'm driving back up there and she's going to have an autopsy. I can take her in my car. And so my brother carried her out under the stars. It was at about midnight, under the stars on the 22nd of July, and seatbelted her in and joked about, you know, don't get pulled over. You're going to have a hard time explaining this one if you do. We found that those moments after she passed were full of heartache, but also there was laughter and joking and, you know, things that seem kind of macabre were comforting. Like at one point I was holding her and her, you know, the blood pools, and I said, gosh, her face is really, really pasty white. But if I tip her, then the color will come back to her face.
Yeah.
You know, just dumb jokes that seem almost shocking to people outside of the situation. But
Jenny and I are sitting here nodding yes, because there's little widowisms that we will say, you know, about our dead husbands that some people think, well, that's kind of disrespectful, but it's just the way it is. And unless you've experienced it, you just don't know.
Yeah.
We're going to come back and we will pick up where you're going with this and talk about, you know, how you do get to that point of figuring out how to move forward. It's not ever necessarily moving on, Jenny and I like to say, but it is about finding that way, that path forward. So we'll take a break and we'll be right back, and okay, we'll talk again. And we're back with John and Monica English. This is just, I know the story and I actually love this little girl so much that it's, I've been struggling holding back some tears, and I'm finding that gut check of loss just revisiting this with you guys both. But, you know, the thing about loss and discussing it and talking about it, it is hard, and it does live in our bodies. You do feel it. But it's also good because you were touched so deeply by someone you love so much. And in that way, it's a beautiful thing to be able to talk about them again. So I really appreciate you guys coming on and being willing to share Talia with us. You were talking about sharing with Noni and Ethan, her older siblings that had gone through so much of their own sacrifices, having to have their parents gone so often and sometimes unexpectedly for long stretches of time, not knowing when you'd get back to them. And then having to explain that she's gone and she won't be coming home.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I was lucky enough to have, we were lucky enough to have, is I had a friend who was the chapter president for the Funeral Consumers Alliance. And so this friend had done a lot of research in what the laws were around funerals and what you could or couldn't do. And there was a lot of latitude that I didn't know I had, that we didn't know we had for funerals. And the first one was we worked with a funeral home that where I asked for her body to be brought the day before the funeral so that we could dress and spend some alone time in our own home with her. And as we dressed her, we let our kids come in and out as they felt comfortable. We let them touch her. Nani painted her toenails and her fingernails, which is something she always loved doing. And we held her and sang to her and put her to bed in her own bed the night before she was to be buried. But it allowed us some very private, beautiful moments that were, it gave me my time. I didn't feel like I was on show, which you really can be at a funeral event.
I love that you have Talia the viewing.
Talia loved The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
And she was really looking forward to being Dorothy for Halloween that year. And a dear friend of ours, Holly Richardson, made a Dorothy costume. And we dressed her as Dorothy when we put her into her casket. And the casket itself, I just asked an uncle, could you please make a box? And he said, I'm a cabinet maker. I can make it fancy. And I said, nope, we just want a box. And we painted it. We painted it white. We put rainbows on the inside of the lid. And on her birthday, which was 2 days after she passed, we had a birthday party and family members and friends came over and painted their hands with handprints. And we had handprints of all the people that loved her on her casket.
It was so beautiful. And I love the fact that you guys had the viewing in her room.
In her room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. I remember another friend of mine looked at her and said, I didn't know they would let you do that. And I said, really, who is they? And she said, I don't know. It was a really sweet way to do a viewing. And the funeral itself, we wanted it outside under the sky. We held it in an outdoor amphitheater and we put her stuffed animals, her beloved Elmo and different stuffed animals in the trees and around. We let off balloons. We sang Somewhere Over the Rainbow. We just decided we wanted it to be a little girl's funeral, something where if she invited her friends, they would have a good time.
Yeah.
And there were lots and lots of tears, but there was also lots and lots of joy for having had her in our lives.
Yeah. Yeah, it was amazing. It was such a beautiful, it was terribly sad. I mean, a funeral of a four-year-old is tragic all in itself. And you see them bringing out the small little box and it was so hard. And we had so many mutual friends and birthing women, doulas and people that I was there with, attending with. And I know that we all gathered a little bit together and we were just so heartbroken and just so badly wanted to be able to, you know, it's like when you're supporting that woman in labor and you just wish that you could take that one contraction I just wish I could take one contraction for you. I just wanted to take 5 minutes of your grief. If we all could just carry 5 minutes of Monica's grief, could that make it better? And of course, you can't do that. But
grief for me was so like labor in reverse.
Mm-hmm.
I had waves that came like contractions.
Yeah,
they just did, and they would swell and they would overcome me, and then they would ease and go, and you cry. And as you go on throughout the years, or at least for me, as we went through time, those contractions, those grief contractions came further apart.
Right.
And there was more break in between.
Yeah. I often think about it very much, you know, birth is, and those contractions coming in get closer and more together and more intense. But even in losing John, because he lost his life to cancer, mm-hmm. and it was a very slow, and the last 10 days were a very traumatic experience, and a very slow parting. That process of death and slipping out of the world was kind of the reverse of labor. And then my grief followed pretty much suit. It came on suddenly and intensely. And then, like you say, it gets further apart and more manageable. And it's kind of the reverse of bringing life into the world. It is very similar, very much the same and very different.
Well, this to me is all completely new. I'll admit I wasn't familiar with this illness before. I don't know either of you. I didn't know your story other than what Michelle has shared with me. I'm curious, where did the concept of having such a personalized funeral come from? Was that something you had thought about while she was still living, knowing that you might lose her? Or did that just come in the moment? Because I think, you know, right when my husband died, you're right in the thick of that grief. And if you're using the labor contraction analogy, well, then you're like, you know, right at a nine and, you know, the height of labor. That's not really when most of us think really clearly.
Right.
And it's not really when most of us think creatively. You know, I remember my husband's funeral being something where I'll admit I felt, whether consciously or not, kind of this social expectation of this is what a funeral is. This is what a funeral looks like. Even if there's not a law that says this is how funerals have to be done, we're kind of cultural people and we kind of bury people the way we bury them, and we have funeral homes host the viewing the night before and what. So I'm just curious, and I know Michelle has said she has since planned every funeral for everyone she loves in her mind, but I now see why she says that, because at first that sounded a little bit odd, like, okay, bury everybody you love in your mind, that's fine. But I see this
I planned their funerals. I didn't bury them.
Okay. Well, in your mind. I said in your mind. Yeah.
But
in
I didn't bury them. I just planned their funeral, I would honor them.
Now I see what you mean. And I see where you were going with John's celebration of life, being at the racetrack and not necessarily at the church or the funeral home. So, John and Monica, I'm just curious, is that something that you had given thought to in the 4 years you had her, knowing that you weren't expected to have her long? Or can you talk a little bit about that? And how you kind of got to the point where it wasn't matter. You didn't care what they said you were supposed to do for a funeral. You were going to do what you felt comforting. And other people might look at it and go, whoa, that's really unusual or unconventional. Who cares? This is our daughter. This is our celebration of her little life.
I'm a researcher, which has served me well with a number of different medical conditions that my children have had and we have had, but when I knew she was going to die, I threw myself into two paths for my life. One was that she would live forever, that if we did these new things that were so new on the scene, maybe my child could live to 20 or 25 or 30. And I planned for that, but I also planned for her to die at any point. And so I started thinking about funerals, and I remember she was in the intensive care unit when I got my hands on the book Stiff about all the different ways to dispose of a body, not dispose, but what happens in the different, whether it's cremation or burial or
other burial at sea, what happens to the body. And it was fascinating to me. And it helped me to understand what my life might look like if she passed. And the friend I mentioned also had an understanding of things like, no, you don't have to embalm if you don't want to. You can, but it's not a legal precedent. And so she told us about some of the things I might not have expected. And you don't need a casket. You could bury someone in a cardboard box. Just all of those funny little details. And I started putting things together. I read of other people's unusual funerals and thought, when my daughter passes, because she's going to pass, it's going to be a funeral that speaks to her life, not to the societal norms that I happen to live in. And there were people who were pretty shocked, and some people absolutely loved it, and some were confused by our approach. But yeah, it's definitely something I thought about over and over again during her life, knowing that I had a child with a terminal illness.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I had just wondered, and I love how you said that in those moments immediately after she was gone, that there were obviously a lot of tears, but there was also a lot of laughter. I picture myself in my living room the very day my husband died, as people came to visit, and then the next day was a Sunday, that first weekend. And I remember we laughed so much. Yeah. And I would sometimes catch myself and think, I should not be laughing. Like, this is not a time for laughter. And then how quickly I would correct myself and think, what else would my husband want me to do but to feel joy as we remember him, as we celebrate him, as we share funny stories, his childhood friends or his family or people who knew him long before I ever did. And as there's that special existence. It's almost like a different realm immediately when a person passes away, whether it's sudden or expected. I mean, yours was more anticipated. Michelle's was anticipated through John's illness. Mine seemed to come completely out of the blue. And yet I can't even find words for it. It's like you're in a different dimension, a different realm. And yet it's a very beautiful realm. And you can feel heartache and happiness at the same time, which I'll admit I wasn't sure was possible before. I thought you had to be happy or sad. I thought you had to be strong or weak. And I realized, oh no, when that veil between life and death gets so thin, and when you're coming or going, and the same can be true. I love that you've likened this unto childbirth. I've given birth 7 times and never really taken the time to think about how that compares to my experience with grief and my husband leaving life. But that special realm that exists when life feels really clear for a minute. The things that matter most really are clear. All the periphery things that you usually get caught up in the day-to-day that worry you and take all of your time and energy and attention kind of melt away, and you just focus on your love for that person, whether it's the person that's come into this world or the person that's just left this world. Everything else seems to melt away, and it's as if, I mean, I picture myself almost floating, like nothing felt concrete, nothing felt so mortal. And so to hear you say that you experience the same thing, where you're able to crack jokes while sending your baby daughter's body for an autopsy, like from the outside, that is weird. And yet if you know, but because I've been in that, not with a child, but I've been in that realm and losing my husband, I know what you mean. And it's a very beautiful, sacred bubble that you walk in for that little while. I just don't find the right words for it. But hearing you say that makes me feel like, oh, yeah, I get that. I get that. I can't describe it, but I get that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've read it when you have experienced it.
Yeah. And you can't explain it, because it does sound like you're either blasphemous or cold-hearted or just crazy or all of the above.
I have written about this several times. In fact, during my process of losing John, the 2 years he was sick, I would often make some Facebook posts about, I never understood that you could experience excruciating pain and joy all at the same moment. And and they're not necessarily separate. And I remember the moment.
And they're certainly not opposites.
Right.
They're certainly not opposites.
Yeah. Which is so crazy. I remember the moment that John died, and I remember writing on Facebook something to the fact that, or maybe it was a message to my family. I am so ecstatic. I'm elated right now. I'm so overjoyed that he has passed on. And I know that this moment is going to pass. But in the moment I was writing it, I was also in excruciating heart pain, physical pain.
Both.
And yet I was screaming over the side of his body, "You made it, baby. You made it.
You're
you
done.
Crossed the finish line. You don't have to do this anymore." And I'm going to make myself cry, but
you're going to make us all cry. So it's beautiful.
Yeah. It's such an intense emotion when you're the one experiencing it. And I totally get it.
I was just going to say, I'm super excited for what is still yet to be shared. I know we've talked about making this kind of a part one and part two episode. John and Monica, if you're willing to come back with us, I feel like to try to wrap things up right now would be
too tight.
A huge disservice to all of us who are hanging on your every word. And yet we want to be able to have time to maybe do a part two to this and walk us through. So what's it been, 16, almost 17 years then since you lost Talia, and what came next, and what's happened since, and where are you now, and where is science and medicine now, and all of the different things. I feel like this is definitely like giant cliffhanger here, but we're going to have to come back.
There's definitely more to the story, more that they have not told us yet about CJ and about the testing that comes to their family and what they discover about SMA and their genetics. And there's just so much more to the story to tell. So I'm looking forward to bringing them back, catching up, starting there, and walking through those days of losing Talia, finding out what you find out, and then you end up getting pregnant with another child, and her name's Tabitha.
Yes.
And then sharing that story as well. So much information, really. 2 hours isn't really even long enough, but hopefully we'll make it through the next hour and be able to let people hear the rest of your amazing, amazing story, and really just some cool gifts that your family has actually been able to bring, not only to Utah, but SMA families everywhere.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much
for having us.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back, and we'll make sure we share these episodes very close to each other. To our listeners, thank you for joining us. We hope you've enjoyed what John and Monica have had to share, and stay tuned, because in a couple of days, we will be launching the second half of this interview. We're grateful always for you when you listen. We'd love to have you leave us a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to contact us, or maybe let us know about someone you know, or maybe it's you yourself willing to share your real life story of resiliency and overcoming hardship, we'd love to hear from you. You can find us on Facebook or Instagram at Relentlessly Resilient, or contact us through email at rrpodcast@ksl.com. And as always, no matter what you do today, remember to be kind. You have no idea the struggles other people are facing in their lives. Thanks, everybody.
Bye.